On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Plenty to discuss in today's Sunday papers. Let's give you a quick tour of what's making the front pages this morning. The Sunday Independent leads with the fact that Tony Houlihan and Ronan Glynn, that's the Chief Medical Officer and the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, have been subjected to menacing and threatening phone calls, which are now under Garda investigation. They received the sinister calls on Friday. In the case of Dr. Glynn, the call was made to his landline. A member of his family answered and was subjected to the abuse. According to sources, Garda were contacted in both instances and are now investigating. Security sources say that Garda technical experts, who are experienced in tracking calls, are now attempting to establish where exactly they came from. There is also a great piece on the front page of today's Sunday Independent, which previews or gives a taster of a really fascinating read inside, which one of our panellists just said it's a shame that we're not going to get time to talk about it, but we might actually set a couple of minutes aside later in the hour to discuss it. Sinead O'Connor, that's the Sinead O'Connor, has conducted a fascinating sit-down interview with Ian Bailey about the new level of fame, notoriety, call it what you will, that he's been exposed to because of the two latest documentary series made about the killing of Sophie Toscan du Plantier. Really, really fascinating interview. And actually, when it's conducted by someone who you wouldn't usually have down as someone who does good print interviews, obviously Sinead O'Connor is new to the print sector, but it's a fascinating piece, and we might get a chance to talk about it a little bit later this hour with our guests, who I'll introduce in just a second. That story about the calls to Tony Houlihan and Ronan Glynn also makes the front page of the Sunday Times this morning. We're told that Gardaí have launched an inquiry into threatening and nuisance calls made to senior members of the National Public Health Emergency Team. The campaign of harassment appears to have been coordinated, Gardaí believe. It began on Friday after the Dáil had voted the previous evening to extend emergency powers to deal with the pandemic. These allow restrictions on travel and social gatherings to be imposed until November without another vote. We are told that Tony Houlihan's private telephone number and home address were uploaded and circulated among online groups of anti-vaccine protesters and conspiracy theorists on Friday. Gardaí believe that the information was obtained from an old Aircom telephone book and was not a data breach. The circulation of Tony Houlihan's home address was followed by a series of nuisance and threatening phone calls. The main story in the front page of the Sunday Times today, something which I've noticed is already getting a little bit of scrutiny online this morning: under 16s could get COVID jabs this summer. We're told that the government is preparing to vaccinate under 16s this summer, beginning with those who have underlying medical conditions, once the National Immunisation Advisory Committee approves the use of the Pfizer jab for children aged 12 to 15. We're also told that Greyhound Racing Ireland has been left with a legal bill of about €350,000 after it failed in a High Court application to stop animal rights activists from protesting at the Shelburne Park track. And we're also told on the front page of the Sunday Times today that Brown Thomas's refusal to allow the full pedestrianisation of South William Street has cost Dublin City Council up to €65,000 to redirect traffic out of the store's car park. A lot of the campaign to try and have South William Street fully pedestrianised has been somewhat undermined by the fact that there is a large and very heavily used Brown Thomas car park on that street, and it would now turn out that the City Council has incurred quite significant expenses in having to try and work around that as it deals with some pedestrianisation trials. The front page of the Business Post also this morning has something of a COVID story. We are told that ministers and advisers are clashing over the plan for indoor dining. Proposals to reopen indoor dining by July the 26th remain on track this weekend, but tensions have increased over the Cabinet's decision to allow unvaccinated under 18-year-olds into indoor hospitality settings when they're accompanied by parents. Now, they've spoken to Cathal Walsh, who's a member of the Mathematical Advisory Group, which advises NPHET. He's also a professor in statistics at Maynooth University. He describes the situation as incredibly risky and exactly what we don't want to happen. He says it will lead to increased transmission, and it is exactly the sort of increased transmission we don't want to see. It is actually incredibly risky. However, one minister has told the paper, "We are sticking with the plan, and we have no plan to change it." Also, apparently the global corporate tax rate could be a little bit over 15%, according to the OECD, despite the campaign globally to have it raised to a minimum of 15%. And finally, for now, the Irish Mail on Sunday: Delta surge won't delay opening plans. Voters and ministers have backed the plans of Micheál Martin for the summer reopening as COVID-19 cases soar in the face of the Delta variant. Senior ministers said this weekend that the significant spike in cases will not derail the government's plan to fully reopen pubs and restaurants from July the 26th. And inside, there is an opinion poll which suggests that, broadly speaking, the public is also for now in favour of reopening indoor hospitality at the rate shown by the government. So to discuss all of those and more, I'm joined in studio by Elaine Loughlin, who's Deputy Political Editor of the Irish Examiner, and by Hugh O'Connell, Political Correspondent with the Irish Independent. Good morning to you both. I hope that you and your small children got slightly more sleep than I and my small child did last night. Jeez, it was very difficult to nod off at all last night. We will discuss other things in greater detail, but Elaine, just before we do move on, the fact that there are front page stories in two of today's papers about sinister or somewhat, you know, undermining or threatening phone calls to the CMO and Deputy CMO, it's not a great position to be looking at, really, is it?
No, and I think both the CMO and Deputy CMO, while they've been the public face of this pandemic in many respects, it has to be remembered that they are private individuals and do have families who have no role in any decisions that are made regarding COVID-19 or the restrictions. And we saw it previously with government ministers as well, that their homes were picketed and targeted. And again, they have a public role, but they are private individuals. And I think that has to be remembered in all of this.
Yeah, that they're not elected officials. They didn't opt into this sort of level of scrutiny. Even if you ever thought that ministers' homes or anything like that were fair game, certainly it's not the case when it comes to people who are just civil servants. Hugh, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's awful, obviously, and it shouldn't happen. But I think it's an indication, perhaps, that we are in a phase of the pandemic now where society is a bit more divided, and it's unfortunately leading to situations where this arises. It's inexcusable. It shouldn't be happening. But, you know, we saw the protests outside the convention centre last Wednesday. Was it Wednesday, Thursday night?
Wednesday night after the bill had passed, yeah.
You know, so, you know, clearly, you know, decisions like the one to effectively divide society into people who are vaccinated and unvaccinated for the purposes of accessing indoor dining are controversial. It's deployed in other countries, but it seems to be particularly controversial here. We'll see how it works when it gets up and running at the end of the month. But all of this is driving a coarsening of the debate, and which is really, you know, sad to see and unacceptable. And obviously it's totally unacceptable that these guys, who are civil servants, who many of us wouldn't have known the names of prior to this pandemic, are now being targeted in such a way. And journalists as well. I mean, we shouldn't forget Fergal Bowers from RTÉ got a call like this, or a sinister, menacing, automated phone call at 3:30 in the morning. And that shouldn't be happening either.
No, certainly shouldn't. I think that the fact you mentioned that it's becoming a more divisive point, I think that that's kind of broadly reflected in a lot of the writing about COVID this morning. Elaine, we'll start with yourself. Is there anything that jumped out for you in today's papers about the coverage of COVID?
Yes, certainly. And the Mail on Sunday as well has spoken to a number of sources, government sources, saying that there's no turning back now when it comes to indoor dining, and that they're going to press ahead despite the warnings from NPHET. And we did have Tony Hoolan come out last week say that children, while allowed, should not be inside in pubs or restaurants. So it's causing a lot of frustration, I think, or a lot of certainly confusion anyway amongst the public. They're being told that you're allowed to do one thing, whether it's indoor dining or a foreign holiday, but really you shouldn't.
Yeah.
And you know, the government is telling them one thing, health advisors telling them the other. You can understand why people are just getting sick of it all now at this stage.
Yeah.
And there was a poll as well, and that in the Mail on Sunday, 63% of those polled are in favour of a further easing of restrictions.
Yeah, I think that poll in the Irish Mail on Sunday is quite interesting this morning, because it says that 38% of people believe that things are opening up at about the right pace. And then in a reflection to you of what you were saying about how, you know, this is becoming slightly more divisive, you have 35% of people who think that things are opening up too much, and 25% of people who think that things aren't opening up nearly quickly enough. So I suppose that government line during the week that this is the acceptable and appropriate happy medium, at least seem to be borne out by the opinion poll.
It does. You know, but I think even in government they're kind of concerned about whether they can go ahead with the relaxation of indoor dining on July 26th. Now, the plan is to go ahead. That's all of the indications picking up from talking to people in government yesterday, was that it is going ahead and that they have cover, I suppose, from NPHET on this. There's also a sense that they're too far advanced in terms of the discussions with the hospitality industry about getting this system set up, you know. But there's a nervousness about it. There's anxiety about it, because, you're opening up an activity that is inherently more risky with a more transmissible variant, circulating around the country.
Even if it is to people who primarily have the protection of vaccines.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, if you're creating a situation where you can bring children under 18 who are unvaccinated into an indoor dining setting, again, it's risky. It's a risky thing. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why, we're reporting today in the Sunday Independent that, NEFID has been asked to advise on whether indoor summer camps and things like this, communions, confirmations, christenings can go ahead in some way, shape or form this summer. But again, the feeling amongst public health there is that that's a really risky thing to do, because if you have all of these children mixing, particularly in the indoor summer camps, they're all unvaccinated. If they are transmitting the virus amongst each other, they're not getting particularly sick, but they're bringing it home to unvaccinated parents. But there's always the chance of a breakthrough infection. And that's, if you have high volumes of people doing that, there's always a chance, albeit a small one, of breakthrough infections amongst the vaccinated population. Yeah. And that's where you get the difficulties in terms of hospital capacity and such like, and things like that. So,
and I think that's one thing that maybe isn't being picked up on here. The real issue here is our hospital capacity. And we were told at the start of this pandemic that the number of ICU beds would be increased dramatically. And that hasn't happened. We were behind most of Europe when it came to capacity long before COVID hit. And now we're really suffering the consequences of that as a result.
I'm just trying to pull up the most recent figures actually. As of Friday night, because last night's figures haven't been published by the HSE, there were 36 available intensive care beds. There were 304 overall, which is actually, in fairness, a little bit of an increase on what was available on an ordinary basis before the outset of the pandemic. But 261 beds were occupied. Now, that's only 23 with COVID-19, but it does go to underline how much other stuff hospitals have to be doing while they're also dealing then with a COVID surge. And generally speaking as well, in terms of overall hospital beds, there was only 212 beds available in general across the hospital sector on Friday night. So any significant wave of new people being admitted to hospital with COVID-19 would definitely be bad news. I don't know whether you had the same thought when Elaine was telling us about that line in the Mail on Sunday, Minister saying that it is going to go ahead. Yeah. I hear that and I think famous last words.
Yeah, look, think back throughout this pandemic. I mean, in January, the schools were opening after Christmas until like 3 days before.
Until they weren't.
They decided that they weren't going to open them, and they didn't open until, was it March or April? Look, we're July the 18th, so we're 8 days out from this now. Things could change. I mean, the rate at which cases are growing now in this country is, exceeding the expectations of even, I think, the worst case scenario in the modelling that was presented to government earlier this month. So in that scenario, if there's a worrying increase in hospitalisations and ICU admissions, you're probably going to get perhaps advice that this mightn't be a good thing to do after all. And I think the Taoiseach was down in Cork yesterday and he was talking about how there'll be further meetings this week. The plan at the moment is that the reopening of the hospitality or of indoor hospitality will go to Cabinet, and the guidelines and such will go to Cabinet, I think, on Tuesday, Wednesday. And it's full systems going. Again, talking to people in government yesterday, very much the view that it is happening and there's no sense that it's not happening. But like you say, we could be here next Sunday, and the view could be that it has to be delayed.
Do you get by the by, because I think they're going to have to make decisions this coming Wednesday as well for what happens in August, and there's still a lot of people hanging by the telephones wondering how many people they could have at a wedding, for example, in August.
I wouldn't think that, given the state of the virus, that you'd be looking to increase the numbers at weddings.
Especially when you're not discerning currently between those who are vaccinated and those who aren't.
Yeah, totally. So, and like August, there was things like pushing capacity on public transport back to 100% again. It's due to go up to 75% from tomorrow. That was a decision taken at Cabinet about 2 weeks ago. But, there was an expectation of a further loosening of restrictions on August 5th, but I'd be surprised if that now went ahead.
I just don't know. Actually, be interested to see if anyone wants to text in on this at 53106 or hashtag on the record NT. I actually don't know how 75% works on a public transport level, because that means that if you have four seats, that three of them are filled. And I don't understand what you think is beneficial by having one seat vacant out of every four. How is that going to try and lower things? Elaine, just going back to the question of international travel, because you mentioned there some of the confusion that people might feel between, Tony Houlihan saying you shouldn't go if you're not vaccinated and the government actually letting you. I seem to remember that it was in the Dáil's final week of recess or before recess last year that there was all this confusion where ministers kept saying, oh, don't go to the green listed countries, even though they're green listed. And actually then if you went to the Department of Foreign Affairs website, they would still say, oh no, if it's a green listed country, you're fine. There's actually no advice against it at all. And just how massively confusing that was. Is it not really the case that maybe 18 months in that people have learned that there is, the advice says that you can do stuff, but also advises you against it, and that people are actually, you know, sophisticated enough and intelligent enough to be able to tell the difference at this stage?
Yes, and it is up to people at this stage to find out both what the rules are for the country that they want to go to, and then what the rules will be when they come back here. So the onus is on people, but I think maybe this week might calm people down when we have a nice wave of hot weather in the coming days. Maybe the urge to go abroad might dissipate slightly.
Well, let's hope that's the biggest wave that we're going to be seeing for the coming days. Hugh, is there anything for you that jumps out in all of the acres of stuff written about COVID in this morning's papers?
You're putting me on the spot there now. But I mean, actually, one of the things that's interesting is what's happening in the UK, where we have
Savid has contracted
COVID-19, or is tested for positive for COVID-19 through a lateral flow test. And as of last night, he was awaiting the result of a PCR test.
I think I've seen that that's been confirmed since.
Yeah. And then this morning, there was some confusion around whether or not Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, were going to isolate or not, and now they weren't going to isolate, and now they are going to isolate. So it is, you can see there now where the infections are breaking through into the political system, even amongst, you know, vaccinated members of the political system. I mean, Savid Javid has had both jabs. So that's, I suppose, giving you an indication of the degree to which the virus is spreading in the UK. Mm-hmm. It's fairly, it looks fairly out of control. They have their Freedom Day tomorrow, where they're lifting all of the public health restrictions. They're repealing all of the legislation that was put in place.
Which three senior members of the government will now be spending in observation,
which doesn't seem very free to me. They're getting rid of their mask mandate, and they're moving at a pace that is causing a huge amount of concern in this country, because things that happen in the UK inevitably have consequences here. That's why we have the Delta variant in Ireland, quite frankly. So that's all quite concerning. And you'd hope that, one positive, I suppose, is what's happened in Scotland, whereas there was a surge of cases, particularly around the Euros, with a lot of Scottish fans coming down to London. They were at 4,000 cases per day, and they're coming down now slightly, which I suppose is testament to some of the measures that they've kept in place there. And I suppose that's what public health experts in the government would be hoping here, that we are due a surge now. We're going to get to 2,000, 2,500, maybe even 3,000 cases a day in the coming weeks, but that will kind of taper off as we get into the latter part of August.
That's the hope. It was striking on that front, actually, that Leo Varadkar was at a press up on Thursday or Friday of the week just gone. He said that if Ireland follows Scotland's trajectory, that it will be a significant challenge for hospitals, but it'll be a challenge that they're capable of meeting. And it kind of struck me as being, on the one hand, that people want the country to be able to open and function, Elaine, but on the other hand, saying that, there's going to be a wave in hospitals and we're prepared to stand over a wave of hospitals because we reckon that they can suck it up. It's a kind of a peculiar line to be drawing.
Yeah, it is, and we will just have to wait and see. The HSE has warned, though, that they may have to reschedule or postpone scheduled procedures in the coming weeks as that next COVID wave hits the hospitals. But on COVID, we've been very negative this morning. I wanted the sun.
we'll draw the positive then. Where's the positive?
Well, the
COVID
sun is shining outside, so we need a bit of positivity in here in the studio. I picked up on a piece in the Sunday Times from the south of France, where they're trying to get young people between the ages of 12 and 30 vaccinated. They're encouraging people to post pictures on Instagram to promote the fact that they've been vaccinated. And the best pick will win tickets to David Guetta, and also will get to go to a military base where they'll get helicopter simulation. It's quirky.
Is that what cool kids do these days? I don't know.
It seems to be, but I think it also highlights how successful our vaccination program has been here. We saw figures this week that it's well up in 90% for the older cohort. Now, it does decrease the younger the age group, and it'll be interesting now that we're in the 30 to 40 age group to see what the take up rate is. But we have seen other countries, they've had to do things like this. You know, there was shots offered to young people in other countries, and also the fact that France as well, it's a bit concerning. They have said that they are going to bring in mandatory vaccination for those people who work in healthcare, which you really wouldn't like to see happening in this country, because it is up to a person to decide what vaccination they get or not. And you wouldn't like to see that here.
Yeah.
Thankfully, it doesn't look like we're going to get to that stage. The vaccine take up is really successful here and we're rolling it out as fast as we can.
I think that story there in the Sunday Times references the Greek government taking a more direct approach, offering all of those aged 18 to 25 €150 cash card and a free month of mobile phone data in return for a shot. I think that's a pretty good idea.
It may be a less niche offering than David Guetta.
Is that the idea that the Fianna Fáil TD, James O'Connor was proposing?
Yeah.
I think he sourced on that basis. But that's because they presumably they need to be given some incentive to take it up, whereas in Ireland, if that's the only way you're going to be allowed to have pints indoors whenever the weather does turn,
or
if you want air-conditioned pints, it might be the only way you can go inside.
That's quite the incentive. But I think there was a vox pop on the radio earlier this week with young people, and a lot of them seem to be expressing misgivings about getting the vaccine. So it'll be interesting to see whether the strong uptake among the older age cohorts translates, or that we see that with younger cohorts. It would appear anecdotally that won't be the case, but. You know, maybe if indoor dining is open and the only possibility to get a pint is to get a vaccine, we'll encourage young people.
That Sunday Times piece says that health authorities in Europe and beyond are trying to curb the spread of COVID, especially the Delta variant, among the young, many of whom don't have symptoms and may be unaware that they're infected. Nearly 4% of people aged 15 to 29 in Catalonia and Spain, for example, have tested positive, which has prompted the reimposition this weekend of an overnight curfew in Barcelona and 160 other municipalities. The problem in many of these countries is that people in their 20s and 30s have only recently become eligible for the jab, but there are also some signs of vaccine hesitancy, because 1 in 4 Americans aged between 18 and 25 said that they probably or definitely would not get jabbed, according to a study from the University of California published this week. Respondents cited possible side effects, including reports of heart inflammation following the Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna jabs. Official responses have not been confined to handing out gifts or targeted advertising. Restrictions are being introduced in some countries, including health passes that need to be shown for entry into venues, which also appear designed to motivate the young. Well, maybe the idea of air-conditioned indoor pints, or whenever the weather does turn, dry indoor pints might be enough to encourage the young people of Ireland. Before we move off COVID, Hugh, you yourself have a piece in today's Sunday Independent about how life in Leinster House is going to look, because it seems as if they are going to be getting back to something of a degree of normality after the summer break.
Yeah, this is the plan for the return of the dole to Leinster House and to end the 26,000 euro a day sittings in the convention centre, which have been hugely controversial. No one likes going to the convention centre, journalists included. And the plan is that when the dole comes back on September 15th, that the rules that apply in society will apply in Leinster House. There'll be strict controls on the numbers in and out of Leinster House. And there'll be statistics kind of put up around Leinster House showing people, the footfall, how many the percentage of people wearing masks. There will still be the requirement to wear masks in September in Leinster House. At the moment, that's the plan anyway. And crucially, and interestingly, vaccine passes will be in operation for the bar and restaurant, as the three of us will be familiar with. Those are indoor settings. There isn't an outdoor restaurant or an outdoor bar in Leinster House. So to get into them, you're going to have to show your vaccine pass. And as we saw during the week, there are a couple of TDs who have been, I suppose, coy on whether or not they've availed of the vaccine.
As is their right.
As is their right. But they are public representatives. But if they haven't been vaccinated and they don't have the vaccine pass, they won't be able to get into the Dole restaurant or the Dole bar.
It is awful that people would target our CMO and Ronan Glynn, says Maria on Twitter. These people are responsible for advising the government regarding health. They're not responsible for the economy. The government that uses that advice to make the decisions that some are unhappy with. But Maria is suggesting that it's the government that people should have an issue with and not just those who are advising it. We also have John on Twitter, who suggests that Paul Reid, discussing this morning the idea of vaccinating younger people, is bordering on a communist regime. How dare you, Mr. Reid, force children to take what he calls this poison? You shouldn't be allowed to use social media as a platform for promoting vaccines. Suspect that's going to be the sort of tone of comment, Elaine, that we're going to see a lot of as vaccination moves into younger categories and teenagers.
Yes, it's always a controversial one when it comes to vaccination of children. And we did see a number of years ago as well, vaccines hesitancy. And we had a number of outbreaks of measles in the country as a result. And also the HPV vaccine initially had great take up and then declined significantly and resulted in the HSE launching an awareness campaign around that to bump up the figures again. Now, thankfully, they had gone up again before COVID struck. So it will be a difficult decision for parents. They will have to weigh up the options of whether they want to get their children vaccinated or not when that becomes an option.
Someone else on Twitter says, honestly, I'm sick of people refusing to take a vaccine and them having a negative effect on my bloody life and endangering my loved ones. I do wish some politician had the balls to tell them it's time to grow up. Someone else, Northside Dub, says, the absolute state of you and your guests, pushing a narrative instead of questioning it, actively encouraging young people to get vaccinated so that they can have a pint indoors. Disgraceful. I'll give you a positive. 99% survival rate for COVID. Also, such a deadly virus that people have to be bribed to take the vaccine. Well, sure, look at me. You're allowed to have your own opinion, and I'm not pushing young people to get a vaccine just so they can have a pint indoors. I'm suggesting that it might be an incentive for them, lads, but each their own. But you do have to accept that it's not going to be safe, really, for large people to be congregating indoors for the time being. Genuinely, you could build entire houses with all the newsprint today that's been devoted to Fianna Fáil, and indeed probably including which it's travails on housing as well. But Hugh, I'll start with yourself, because you've sat down for today's Sunday Independent with Mark McSharry, the one guy who's prepared to put his head above the parapet and say that Micheál Martin should go. What's he been telling you?
Well, he's been telling me a lot, Gavin. I met with him on Friday evening in Dublin, and he really just wanted, I suppose, to get across some of his views as regards the Taoiseach, but also the state of the party and the state of the country. And he was very critical of Micheál Martin's leadership. I mean, that's not new, but I mean, what was striking was that he, you know, in one sentence describes Micheál Martin as authoritarian, totalitarian, but at the same time, you know, he's a gentleman, a very nice man, and a very well-intentioned man. But I think the problem for McSharry, and, you know, Willie O'Dea articulates a little bit of this in his column in the Sunday Independent today, is the centralising of power within Fianna Fáil around the leader and certain people close to the leader, and the extent to which that has manifested itself over the last few years. And in particular, the decision to extend the confidence and supply agreement with Fine Gael in late 2018 by another year was something that Micheál Martin announced in the Dáil unilaterally with no consultation with the parliamentary party. And that is pinpointed retrospectively, I guess, by a lot of people in Fianna Fáil as the moment at which you know, they were tied to Fine Gael in such a way that it affected them in the last general election. They were seen as the same party, effectively, that they were in government together. And now, of course, they are actually in government together.
But it was done without there even being as much of a drop in the line or any kind of a check in the temperature to the rest of the front bench.
Nothing to the front bench. So, look, that's caused, you know, that has been pinpointed as the moment, I suppose, as I say, retrospectively. But, you know, McSharry is outspoken. He uses provocative language. He invoked Robert Mugabe in the course of the interview and then kind of regretted it. You know, we discussed his use of language over the years. You know, he is someone on the record of the Shannon, in fact, you know, referring to Hitler and the Enabling Act. You know, he uses provocative language that he regrets to some extent. But, you know, he's a colourful character. And I think that what came across in the interview is that this isn't going to stop him. One of the reasons we sat down with him, obviously, was the fact that he had been for the last few weeks attempting to secure 10 signatures for a motion of no confidence in the Taoiseach. As he told me, you know, I put it to him that he'd failed, and he said he just hadn't succeeded yet. So, you know, look, at some point he will. That's the reality of it. I mean, there's only one way this ends, as far as I'm concerned, and it's Micheál Martin deciding at some point, probably in the next 18 months, that it's time to relinquish the leadership of Fianna Fáil and allow someone new to take over, because that's the view in the parliamentary party, amongst the majority of the parliamentary party. They speak privately. Only one of them speaks publicly at the moment. But there is a view, and in fact, it's been articulated by a number of backbenchers over the last 5 days that... and articulated publicly, in fact, that, you know, they don't believe Micheál Martin should lead the party into the next election, and some believe that the ideal time to transition to a new leader is when the changeover of Taoiseach, the Taoiseach's office, happens in December 2022.
Elaine, do you think that he will get the time of his own choosing to decide when to step aside, or do you think that eventually the 10 signatures will come and that the weight of the tide will go against him?
I think very few leaders, unfortunately, do get, or fortunately, depending on what side of the argument you're on, do get to decide their fate. We saw it with Enda Kenny, how he eventually was pushed out, albeit semi on his own terms. I also picked up on a piece that Hugh has, and also in the Sunday Business Post, Barry Cowan speaking. So he's in two Sunday newspapers today, which is interesting in itself. While Mark McSharry is certainly outspoken, I think Barry Cowan is more perhaps level-headed and mature in his comments and questions around whether he's perhaps positioning himself now.
Usually it kind of tends to be something that's a little bit choreographed if you're going to show up in more than one Sunday newspaper at a time.
Yes, and he was the one responsible for calling for that review of how Fianna Fáil have done both in the most recent by-election and the general elections of last year. So he was leading the charge on that, writing a letter, very mature language used again. He does know that a leadership contest will happen, whenever that is, remains to be seen. Perhaps he is positioning himself now. I thought Gerard Howlin, he wrote a piece actually on the coalition itself, picked out Micheál Martin and kind of said that his ability to weather every political storm, knowing from experience that the objective today is to be in position tomorrow. And he said he kind of wins top prize for resilience, and you have to give it to him. He has stayed in power over the year and has had multiple setbacks and controversies. And he also points out that there's a number of newly enthused loyalty among some Fianna Fáil TDs. And I certainly picked up on that over the past week. While you do have the Mark McSharries on one side of the argument, you certainly have a not insignificant group of TDs who are very much supportive
of
Micheál Martin.
And now staking their colours to the mast.
Yes, and have said that, you know, especially those who've been elected in this Dáil and the previous Dáil, that they really were supported by Micheál Martin and almost taken under his wing and shown the ropes, and that they would be loyal to him as long as he is in power. So I think there is almost 50-50 split at the moment. Now that probably over time will differ, and I imagine, as Hugh said, as the term comes to an end as Taoiseach, you may see more people jumping to the other side.
Yeah, well, I think it's I think a lot of political leaders have come unstuck when they think that someone that they have given some kind of favour to or any kind of patronage, that they think that that will buy their loyalty, because it's often the case that all you've done is empower your enemies, and then when they decide that you're now a ceiling on their ambitions, that they move you on. One thing I think which is quite striking today, Hugh, that the one member of the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party who's written a piece in his own name, Willie O'Dea, who regularly writes, in fairness, for the Sunday Independent, has managed to write what I reckon is probably about 1,000 or 1,200 words about the future of Fianna Fáil, and has managed never to name the party leader in all of that piece.
Yeah, no, he's but it's a very interesting piece. Again, as I said earlier, he kind of pinpoints the extension of confidence and supply as a moment at which, you know, Fianna Fáil's fate was sealed in the run up to the last election. But he's also talking and writing about this idea that Fianna Fáil really needs to get a period in opposition, which is kind of strange because Fianna Fáil has been in opposition
for 10 years. Yeah.
But I mean, I think he's looking at the numbers in terms of seats for the party, and he's thinking that, you know, after the next election, and he quotes John Downing, my colleague, you know, this idea of whether Fianna Fáil would just end up becoming a mudguard for Fine Gael in government. And in trying to avoid that, Fianna Fáil after the next election probably needs to go into the opposition. Of course, the problem there is that Fine Gael also wants to go into opposition after the next election. So you have all of these parties that don't want to govern or say they don't want to govern, which leaves very few options, I suppose, in terms of governing. It really would fall down to Sinn Féin to try and put together a government with other smaller parties.
One thing which is quite striking about, aside from the point you made about Willie O'Dea drawing attention to confidence and supply, he makes the argument that in other democracies, confidence and supply deals only last for 2.5 years. Then he writes, "We signed up for 3, and then when our separate identity was already under threat, we decided without consultation or discussion to extend the arrangement for another year." Yeah. The result was all too predictable. By the time the election came around, the situation resembled the conclusion of Orwell's Animal Farm, where the rebel animals became indistinguishable from the humans that they were allegedly trying to replace.
I was talking to a couple of senior sort of Fianna Fáil grandees who didn't want to speak publicly over the last few days. Now, one of them, Noel Dempsey, is quoted in the paper today, but I was speaking to another who made the point that, you know, during the 2019 local elections, they were picking up the vibe, particularly from party members, that confidence and supply was a big problem. And Fianna Fáil did very well in the local elections in 2019. In particular, they managed to replace Sinn Féin in certain constituencies and local authority wards where basically the Sinn Féin councillors were viewed by the electorate as not having put in the work, and the Fianna Fáilers were able to capitalise on that. And they had a good local elections in 2019, but that did sort of mask this underlying feeling within the party that this, we've been in this confidence and supply too long. It's damaging us on the ground, and it's going to damage us in the bigger elections. And so it proved.
William D's final line is, in the meantime, Humpty Dumpty has lost his comfortable position on top of the wall and he's hanging by the flimsiest of threads, which is quite the image, Elaine, really, isn't it?
It really is. And I think picking up on what you said there, that William D wants to go into opposition, perhaps he felt that last time round, Fianna Fáil weren't really in opposition. Confidence in supply isn't true opposition, and they want to go into a hard, solid, proper opposition next time.
Mm. Alan on Twitter, going back to our earlier idea about whether younger people could be encouraged to take up vaccinations with the notion of being allowed to drink indoors. The worst thing, as I see it, as your panel of guests suggesting that just a pint will be enough for young adults, are trying to do it on the cheap again. Why do they have to be bribed off with something as little as the idea of getting to drink indoors? There is quite a bit written about the whole general question of how we're going to pay for all this COVID stuff and how we're going to pay for all of the houses that the government is intent on building for the years and decades into the future. And it is all answered in something called the Summer Economic Statement, which was published to not an awful lot of fanfare this week, but something which is actually quite significant. And Elaine, in fairness, it was your paper and your political editor, Daniel McConnell, who was the first to spot this week that there was actually a bit of a barney underway between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil about how we were actually going to pay not only for the COVID response, but also for the houses the government wants to build.
Yes, and it was due to be signed off at Cabinet on Tuesday, and that memo was actually pulled late on Monday night. And so the Summer Economic Statement was not approved. So therefore, they had to have a second Cabinet later on in the week. Finally got the details sorted and agreed. It does seem to be a bit of another giveaway budget. Even if we're in deficit this year, we'll have 1 in 3 euro going to a tax package, as they call it, which is a major win for Fine Gael. They had been wanting to press ahead with this indexation of tax, income tax, as they call it, to make sure that people don't end up paying the top rate of tax as salaries generally increase. But also there'll be 1.1 billion extra spending on capital projects. We're led to believe that a good chunk of that will go on housing. So again, that's probably a win for Fianna Fáil. Mm. Dara O'Brien, Fianna Fáil Minister for Housing right now, he has got himself into a lot of sticky positions in recent months over his plans around housing and the rental crisis. So he really needs this cash injection to get anywhere with sorting housing for once and for all. But again, I'll refer back to Gerard Howlin, who says in the Sunday Times today on this issue that we are in party time. He says it's going to be...
What?
Exactly. We might not have indoor dining yet, but he's claiming that when it comes to spending, it's official, we are in party time. He says it's just in deciding to keep borrowing, the 2020s are set to be the new noughties. And that is effectively what this government are doing. We will borrow our way out of what hasn't been called a recession, but certainly an economic pinch due to COVID, and hope that we can encourage more business and more spending and that the economy will bounce back, I doubt this year, but perhaps from next year.
I would have thought, Hugh, that any kind of a discussion between the coalition partners about how we were going to bridge the gap and how we were eventually going to wean ourselves off all this borrowing, you'd have thought all of that would have been sorted out when they were drawing up a programme for government. Because let's not forget that COVID had already, you know, been, and we already knew there was going to be massive economic consequences for COVID before this government was formed. The idea that they kicked some of the decisions a year further down the road and then even had to buy themselves an extra day to figure out what they were going to borrow and when and what they were going to spend it on. To me, I'm just surprised that all of that wasn't ironed out at least 12 months previous.
You have to remember, Gavin, like, I mean, we have had 6 months of, or nearly 6 months of spending about, I think, 1.2 billion a month keeping the economy shut down this year. So that has had an impact, I suppose, in terms of the numbers. Mm. And I think that is primarily why you're having lots of these barneys now. I mean, effectively, this is about the desire of Micheál Martin and Dara O'Brien to throw as much money as possible at the housing issue, particularly in terms of capital investment. Whereas Pascal Donoghue is looking at it from the point of view that we really do need to start reining back in some of the spending you know, because we spent so much over the course of COVID. And then somewhere in the middle is Michael McGrath, who's the actual public expenditure and reform minister, who's obviously, you know, got his Fianna Fáil hat on, but he's also got his fiscal rectitude hat on. And I suppose that that is the clash. And it's, you know, look, the summer economic statement, I think, commits to increasing spending by 5% per annum over the next 4 years. Like, I mean, that is magic money tree stuff. Like, where is the money going to come from? I mean, it seems to me that it's going to be an awful lot of borrowing. Borrowing's very, the interest rates are very low at the moment, so borrowing is quite affordable. But I mean, at some point over the next 4 years, it's not going to be as affordable as it is now. And at some point over the next 4 years, the fiscal rules, the EU fiscal rules that were relaxed at the start of the pandemic, are going to be unrelaxed or reimposed.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're facing into all of this, and a commitment to balance the books, I think, by 2025, by the end of this government's term. And we can't rule out that we are going to have more pandemic-related expenditure over the next year or two that hasn't really been factored into the figures, because I think the pandemic spending is going to be reduced by about 8 billion next year on what it was this year. But, you know, with this virus, we can't rule out, you know, the potential for further lockdowns or further restrictions down the line. We will have to spend a huge amount more on testing and tracing, on vaccines and so on and so forth. So that's all in the mix at the same time as the government's trying to solve a housing crisis that
we don't want to talk this up any more than it is, but that's not Hugh going on a solo run to suggest there might have to be further restrictions further down the line, because anyone you ask in government always says, yes, ideally, you know, vaccination is going to be our long-term path out of this, but they all say that they can never rule out any further restrictions. And we did have Leo Varadkar saying only a couple of days ago that we're likely to have some restrictions over the winter, and that we'll need to get another winter behind us before we can think that we're actually going to be on the long path out of this. Elaine, just to pick up on Hugh's point about the European fiscal rules, and I get that this isn't very sexy radio for 11:51 on a Sunday morning when the weather is so nice outside, but everyone forgets how important that stuff is, and that how we had a referendum not so long ago to sign up to these rules. We're basically required to try and run a balanced budget or something close to it, and we just don't have the liberty that we used to borrow tens of billions, even if we could afford to pay it.
Yes, and it's exactly why we have budgets now in October as well, because we have to have our budget signed off at a European level, so we don't have that level of manoeuvring that we used to. Another thing that probably isn't sexy at 11:52 on Sunday morning is the 15% global corporate tax rate, and this figures in some of the Sunday newspapers as well. We had my colleague actually Daniel McConnell earlier on this week stating that senior government figures have now conceded that we will have to agree to this. Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue came out the following morning, and while he didn't deny it, he didn't confirm it, which is
de facto confirmation, because any other year, it doesn't matter how far in advance of a budget, when they always say, oh, can't tell you what's coming up in the budget, but you'd say, are we increasing corporate tax? They would always go, no, never, not in a million years. And now Pascal is saying, can't tell you what's going to be in the budget, which is as good a hint as any as the fact that it's 12.5% is going to go.
Yes, for Pascal Donoghue, it was a very watery denial, and I think he probably feels, because they are still in negotiations over this controversial 15% tax rate, which we read today could be slightly over 15%, he can't concede while you're in negotiations, because that's your hand played. So he has to say that the 12% that we currently have, and which has lured many international companies to this country, is a red line, when really it looks like there will be wiggle room and that we will have to sign up to this this global agreement. Whether we go the full 15% or not remains to be seen.
Yeah, well, we'll see exactly what does come up in the budget, which is going to be the second week in October. We did say that we were going to leave a couple of minutes just before we go about that extraordinary interview that's in your own paper today, Hugh. Sinead O'Connor sitting down with Ian Bailey. And we'll let people read it for themselves. But just the sheer, even the environment in which the interview seems to have taken place is just mad. Well,
I definitely recommend reading it, of course. But I mean, I suppose what's interesting about this is that Sinead is asking questions that other journalists won't have asked Bailey. You know, and she filmed some of this, and you can look at it on independent.ie. But you know, just not someone who, I suppose, has worked as a journalist or as trained as a journalist. Yeah. She's just going into areas, I suppose, that other journalists haven't explored with Bailey. you know, we shouldn't forget, I suppose, that there's a lot of coverage of this today in our paper, but I mean, there is a victim here. It is Sophie Toscan Duplantier, and justice has not really been served in her case. You know, Bailey is convicted in absentia in France of the murder of Sophie Toscan Duplantier, but he's in Ireland. He's not in prison, and of course he denies the murder, and there's no charges brought in Ireland. So that's really, I suppose, what we should remember at the forefront of all of this. And Bailey, you know, says some pretty, I think, in my opinion, pretty crass things in relation to Sophie Toscan Duplantier in that interview, which is not nice to see, but at this stage, given how many interviews he's done over the years, it's not particularly surprising either.
No, but I think, again, that's what's striking about it, given how many interviews he has conducted or he has given over the years, the fact that there is so much new territory that appears to be covered by Sinead O'Connor's refreshing line of questioning. Well worth a read on page 8 of today's Sunday Independent. That's all we've got time for. A big thank you to both of you for coming in this morning. Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent with the Irish and Sunday Independent, and Elaine Loughlin, deputy political editor with the Irish Examiner.